Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics. We're a non-profit scientific organisation, also known as ISAP, and I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. This week, as part of our podcast series on fermented foods, we're bringing you an episode from our archives, The Science of Fermented Foods, Part 2. This episode features fermented foods expert and former ISAP board member, Professor Bob Hutkins, speaking about the challenges of studying fermented foods and how food scientists choose strains for fermentation. I hope you enjoy this episode with your hosts, Professor Colin Hill and Professor Daniel Tancredi.
Hello, everybody. My name's Colin Hill.
And I'm Daniel Tancredi.
And welcome to our ISAP podcast. And we want to really welcome back our first guest, who was Bob Hutkins from the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. And in the first podcast, we shared some stories with Bob about his work in fermented foods and some of the fascinating aspects of fermented foods. I guess, Bob, if you're picking a life in research, you might think, oh, I want to work on cancer, or I want to work on, you know, something really influence human behavior. What could I ever learn by working on yogurt? Give me an example of something you can learn by working on yogurt.
Well, thanks for having me back. Pleasure to be here. As I mentioned earlier, it's great to work on a research area where you could actually eat the fruits of your labor. So it's great to work on fermented foods because you could study them and do all the research on them, and then you get to eat the end product. But I will tell you that the one discovery on yogurt that I wish I had made but didn't was way back almost 20 years ago, when a group of lactic acid bacteria microbiologists got together to sequence genomes for the very first time, sequence whole genomes of microbes that were important in fermented foods. And we were all assigned a genome microbe. And the one that I was assigned was one that I had been working on for a long time, Streptococcus thermophilus, which we all know is the yogurt microbe. And this was about in 2004, 2005. And genomes were rare then because they took a lot of effort, sequencing capacity that nobody had in their labs. We had one of the national labs do the sequencing. Cost probably about $1 million if we'd had to pay for it. But in my lab, in my possession, I had the first genome for Streptococcus, or one of the very first for Streptococcus thermophilus, the yogurt microbe. And we were first starting to learn about how to analyze genomes, and we kind of scanned around that genome looking for interesting things. And the typical things that we found the things that you would expect to find, lactose fermentation, proteolysis, and so forth. We made a great paper, great study. But about 2 years later, 2 or 3 years later, a group of scientists from industry and academia, analyzed that genome and other Streptococcus thermophilus, and they discovered the function of CRISPR. So it was one of my great regrets that I had the genome way ahead of everybody and wasn't looking for, nor would I probably recognize what CRISPR was all about. But there you go. I probably wouldn't be a hardworking university professor had I discovered CRISPR. I'd be off in some Greek island somewhere.
Yeah, I think if you had made that discovery, maybe we would have introduced as the Nobel Prize winning because the Nobel Prize is actually awarded, of course, to people for their development of CRISPR as a gene editing device. Yeah, that was hard luck. One thing that we touched on in the first podcast that I thought was really interesting, and I wanted to come back and revisit it with you, is this whole idea that fermented foods could be good for you in more than one way. I mean, we know fermented foods are good for you because they're very safe, they're tasty, they have lots of nutrients, and so they meet nutritional requirements. But you also touched on the fact that the live microbes present in some fermented foods, you did warn us that not all fermented foods in their final state still contain the living microbes, but that the living microbes could play a role in health as well. And so I wanted to kind of revisit that. When you're picking the kind of bacteria or microbes you're going to use to make a cheese or fermented meat or a sourdough bread or whatever, surely, you know, health benefits aren't uppermost in your mind. What kind of traits are you looking for in these cultures that you're selecting?
So I think this is a misperception a lot of people have, is that the microbes in fermented foods are selected based on their health attributes. And indeed, that's not the case. The microbes that end up in your yogurt and your cheese and your kombucha, other fermented foods, are selected based on their performance traits. Their ability to, probably number one, is make a good flavor, good textured product. But they also have to do their job quickly. They have to be able to be compatible with other microbes that might be in that culture. They have to be able to tolerate the salt, the acid, the ethanol that also is in those products. They have to be stable to the preservation, freezing and drying. They have to be able to grow at the temperature and atmosphere that the food is in. So there's a number of requirements for those microbes, but health attributes isn't one of them, okay? With few exceptions. So there might be some microbes that are used in some cultured dairy products, for example, yogurt, where the microbe does two things. It not only does the fermentation, produces the acids and the flavor and the texture, but those microbes might also do double duty and provide some health benefits. But their real function is to make a good tasting, well-textured, well-preserved fermented food.
And some people outside the field may not even be aware. I mean, there's whole companies, big companies, just devoted to making and producing these cultures, and they have big culture collections. And would taking two different cultures to make a cheese, two different lactococcus lactis, would you end up with a different then product each time, or are they that different from one another?
So that is indeed the goal of many of the culture companies, is to produce strains that have all those characteristics that I just mentioned. I should actually mention I'm resistant to bacteriophage. That's very important in the dairy industry. But to produce cultures that have all those properties yet be consistent. So the compatibility issues, so you might have a strain that produces, it's good for ripening that cheese, proteolysis and so forth. Another strain that's good for fermentation, they have to be compatible and produce consistent product. You know, in the bygone era, and we're talking maybe just 150, 200 years ago, it was kind of c'est la vie when you made fermented foods. You were using wild cultures. Sometimes it made a great product, a spectacular product. Think of wine, you know, a vintage wine of some year. The grapes were perfect. The fermentation was perfect. It aged perfectly. But you do the same thing again the next year or the next vat or whatever it happens to be, and it's not so good. And you live with that. You live with the risk of a spectacular product and maybe one that's just average. But in the modern world, that's consistency is the name of the game. So you want a large company producing cheese or yogurt, want the same every day. And that's challenging because you're in contrast to other food processing industries, this is the only one where the main ingredient, a live living organism, and not an inert material like an emulsifier or a stabilizer.
Oh, well, the little picky part of me, Bob, was thinking, you know, when we say health properties, you nicely explained that it's not so much the selection based on health promoting properties, but surely the microbes that are found to have adverse effects in the dosages that may be needed, I guess that would sometimes rule out a candidate that might otherwise have really attractive properties from a performance standpoint.
Yeah. So again, the ability to produce that strain at a high cell density, be able to freeze it, freeze dry it, hold it at maybe ambient temperatures, that could be a deal breaker for a culture strain. If it has all those great properties that I mentioned before, but it's not stable, then it's all for naught.
And do you think we might have lost some bacteria that would have had good health promoting properties by constantly selecting for, you know, industrial performance as the main criteria? Do you think cheeses of 100 years ago would have been more health beneficial because they would have had a bigger variety of organisms? Or do you think it's better to have a more controlled process and a more, obviously it is for the producer, but is it for the consumer?
Well, that's a really good question. And cheese is a good example of that because among the changes that have occurred in cheese making over the last 100 years or so, it's not only the application of pure starter cultures, but the pasteurization of milk. And so which will affect the flavor and texture. So an unpasteurized raw milk cheese, which many people find much more attractive than pasteurized versions, but you have all those wild microbes that are contributing to flavor and texture. And it's possible that some of those wild microbes could contribute to health benefits. But again, that would have to be, just like for probiotics, that would have to be tested and demonstrated. But for sure, I would say that those wild organisms probably did have a role in some of the other attributes of those fermented foods.
So contrast to that, probiotics, which you mentioned there, they are selected for their health promoting properties, or at least they're tested until they demonstrate a health promoting property. But they also have to perform commercially, I guess. They have to grow. They have to be able to be freeze dried or dried or something. So it doesn't rule out the fact that from, you know, these strains selected for their industrial properties couldn't also have health benefits, or am I wrong there?
Yeah, so the fermentation microbes, in addition to those parallel to those traits that I mentioned before for good flavor, rapid fermentation, and so forth, some of those traits may overlap or be shared with traits that could confer health properties. So, for example, one of the main roles of fermentation microbes is to produce acids and other end products that will inhibit pathogens and competitors and less desirable microbes. Those bacteriocins that are effective in a fermented food, in sausage, for example, to inhibit Listeria or Clostridium, those same end products, the bacteriocins, the acids, the organic acids, could also be produced in vivo in the gut and deliver health benefits, and that's very possible, and that's been theorized, and that's even been tested, at least in laboratory animals. It'd be difficult to do those kinds of challenge studies in humans. So that's one trait. The ability of a microbe to adhere to the leaves of a cabbage or a vegetable, in the case of kimchi or sauerkraut, those adherence properties, encoded probably by some sort of adherence genes in that microbe, could also be relevant in the gut to adhere to mucins or epithelial cells. The ability to produce bioactive compounds in food, same, those bioactives could be produced in situ in the human. So another really good example, we were talking about yogurt, is the ability to produce exopolysaccharides, which in yogurt provides viscosity and body, so it's a highly desirable trait. But in the body, those oligosaccharides may be prebiotic. So you could consider those are shared traits. It's very attractive to hypothesize that those could be considered health beneficial traits.
Yes, I'm intrigued by the different mechanisms of action that can promote good performances in food development, but are also good at promoting health. And you mentioned also like being able to degrade fibers is kind of a valuable thing. So live microbes have been sort of displaced from our diet because of all of the food processing that takes place, and the role maybe for fermented foods to be able to introduce the beneficial live microbes.
Sure. So there's this notion, some people have called it the industrialized microbiome, but it basically states that prior to maybe this 21st century even, that we consume more microbes in our diet. We were surrounded by microbes if we lived in a more pastoral or rural environment growing up on farms. We're always exposed to microbes, but probably in the later part of the 19th century, early part of the 20th century, we became industrialized and our foods became, we became more hygienic and our foods became pasteurized or canned or processed to remove many of the microbes. And of course, we were exposed to antibiotics and just cleaner, more hygienic life. Now,
thank goodness.
Yeah. In many respects, that's been a really, really good thing. So food poisoning, which was probably so common. So I kind of hinted at those days, back in the days, fermented foods were common, but there were probably so many accidents of a sausage that went south or a cheese or other fermented food that didn't, that failed. And people still ate the product. And we know that people used to eat bread that had mycotoxins, because that was the only available source. And so there were horrible incidents of food poisoning and foodborne infections, but there were all sorts of other infectious diseases and people died of infectious diseases. Now, nowadays, pre-COVID, we thought infectious diseases were kind of a thing of the past, but even in the turn of the previous century, tuberculosis in milk was common. So I really want to emphasize that our hygienic lifestyle has had many positive, overall, it's indisputable that it's been a positive for human health. That being said, we have depleted probably our gut and our human microbiome of many of the microbes that were co-inhabited us, that probably were protective. And all these autoimmune diseases that we hear about are probably evidence of that. So the notion that consuming fermented foods or other foods that contain live microbes could replenish those depleted microbes is certainly a really attractive hypothesis. And many of us are trying to figure out ways to test that hypothesis, but it's not so easy. There's all sorts of observational studies and epidemiological studies that hint at that, but testing that in a clinical study is very challenging. I'm still trying to figure out how you do that.
And you would even say, Bob, that if you showed that consumption of live microbes through a particular fermented food, for example, that's very rich in them, and one did a very rigorous clinical trial, that evidence that fermented food by itself was beneficial wouldn't necessarily make that food be considered a probiotic. And so what do you mean by that? Like, you wouldn't know exactly what the strains are necessarily?
Or you wouldn't know the big probiotic, as I mentioned before. You have to know the strain, the quantity, its activity, its genome, and you would never have that in a typical fermented food. So I would consider, so if you did that clinical
study. Because there's too many different ones, or what?
And they're going to vary from the very next time you made that sauerkraut or that kimchi or that kombucha, it's different microbes. So there's just no way you could do that experiment. But you could do an experiment that you could show, if you designed it right, powered it correctly, that kimchi from various sources consistently provided some, if you had a measurable health outcome. But that would not, you wouldn't call that kimchi a probiotic. You would just call it kimchi containing live microbes provides X health benefit, reduces the symptoms of IBS, for example, or reduces gas and bloating or whatever the case may be. But you still wouldn't call it a probiotic. But I don't see anything wrong with collecting that kind of evidence. Or maybe it has an immunomodulatory activity. It would be very important and valuable.
I guess as a scientist, then what you probably want to do is, you know, dissect out that kimchi or that sauerkraut and find if there is a single bug in there that is causing that health benefit, develop that then as a probiotic. So it's not that they're mutually exclusive. One could lead to the other. And you're mentioning a third microbial partner quite a bit as well, the microbiota or the microbiome, which is the bacteria that live in us from century from birth to death, and which is quite stable within each individual. So you have a microbiome, I have a different microbiome, and I'm talking largely here about the gut microbiome. Is there any possibility, risk, danger that, you know, when you consume these live fermented foods, they'll change your microbiome? They'll knock out some of your existing members of your microbiome. They colonize you. Or do all these fermented microbes tend to just kind of pass through and not disrupt your existing microbiome?
So that's another really good question. And most of the data that I've seen has shown that the changes to the microbial diversity of your gut changes a little, maybe even significantly. The recent paper out of Stanford did show that consumption of fermented foods, and they were consuming lots of servings, the subjects in that study, there was a change in the diversity of those microbes, but there wasn't big changes. I thought they were pretty modest. And there weren't very many singular changes either, where you could look at up and down. And that's consistent with other studies. And it's mainly because, like you said, the gut microbiome is so stable and recalcitrant to big changes. And they are most of the time just passing through. Again, I mentioned before, if you eat them every day, they're sort of like they're there, but they're still outnumbered. And from what I've read in the more recent literature, they're not establishing themselves, and they're not making big changes in the microbial diversity, at least.
And that would be true as well, I guess, of most probiotic strains, wouldn't it? Even though some probiotics, maybe even many probiotics, are isolated from the gut of another individual, hopefully a healthy individual. They still don't colonize or really change the microbiome of the consumer, do they? I mean, consumers don't really have to worry about making lasting changes just in the consumption of a probiotic or a fermented food.
That's correct as well. Although there are approaches one could take to enhance the establishment of a probiotic, and that's a subject for another day. So if you can combine the probiotic with a resource that only that probiotic or I should say only, but that's where that probiotic has some competitive advantage for that prebiotic, then you could envision a scenario where you've enriched for that probiotic, maybe even can withstand all the competition and can maybe even persist longer than if it were just there by itself.
And if someone had listened to this podcast or maybe both the podcasts together and thought, yeah, I'm concerned with my health, and I want to, you know, live as healthy a life as possible, and I don't think I'm getting enough live microbes in my diet, what practical advice would you give people? What kind of food should they immediately go out and start buying probiotics? I mean, what would your best advice be to somebody who thought, yeah, I'd like to increase the number of live microbes?
Unfortunately, and I've talked to a lot of consumers, in fact, some of them live in my house, and the level of understanding that it takes for the average consumer to go to the pharmacy or to go online and select a probiotic that satisfies the criteria as ISAP has defined it is so difficult, because there often strains aren't even named on that package, and they would have, even if there's a strain there, they would have no way of going to PubMed to try to find a paper that supports that shows evidence for the effectiveness of that strain. If they go online to try to find reputable information, they're going to get bombarded with wrong information. So it is so difficult, and I get asked this question, as we all do: what probiotics should I take? And, you know, it depends on their condition, who they are, all these things. So I've been kind of loath to make probiotic recommendations. And I actually like fermented foods, the diversity of fermented foods. I like yogurts because many of the yogurts have reputable probiotics in them. So I have no qualms of recommending yogurts from major brands. And I have no qualms recommending fermented fruits or fermented vegetables that have live microbes. I think they get a good diversity there. So that's usually my advice, is probiotics in fermented foods and live microbes in wild fermented foods. But I've been kind of hesitant on recommending probiotic supplements.
No, I can understand that. And I'm extending this argument now a little bit. What about the fermented foods that are heat treated, or in the case of sourdough bread, baked or something? Do you think there's any possibility that the health beneficial effects of the live microbes can carry over into the final product? Or do you think once the microbes are killed, all potential health benefits are immediately eliminated?
Well, in certain fermented foods where there's been a heat treatment or a step to remove the microbes, the matrix itself, whether it's bread, of course, the bread has fiber and vitamins just from the flour and from the other ingredients, and the microbes may have actually done some pre-digestion of the proteins, or they may have consumed some of the usable form. So certainly there's that. And of course, I think I mentioned before, nothing wrong with the antioxidants and polyphenols in red wine and beer and other fermented foods. And the microbes do have something to do with that, because they are producing some of the alcohol that helps extract some of those polyphenols from the grapes. But there's this whole field now of postbiotics, which are the dead microbes and their components. And there could certainly be something there in fermented foods. But that's, again, a topic for another day.
All of us that work in health and develop evidence and are scientists like you kind of grapple with the tension between making recommendations that are based on what we currently know, the rigorous evidence that we currently know, and the need to actually develop that evidence, that rigorous evidence. I wonder about the incentives in place to develop evidence for live microbes. It doesn't seem like any company could necessarily profit from that. Have you given any thought to who's responsible for trying to develop that kind of evidence? Is that something that the public sector should be funding, or there should be maybe partnerships with public and private sector?
The funding component is where the rubber hits the road, because we'll never get to the point where we could have established benefits and get the evidence that we need unless we have substantial funding. These clinical studies are very expensive. So I was really glad to see the Stanford paper and others in Collins Home Institution. They do a lot of clinical work on health benefits of probiotics and prebiotics and fermented foods more recently. But getting the funds to do that work is, I'm sure Colin would say, is not easy. Companies don't have the resources to do that. So I think they're going to have to come from the public sector. And again, I was glad that I think the Stanford study, I think they had some funding from the NIH and other sources. So I think that's what it's going to take. And I'm glad to see that some of those public scientific organizations are willing now to fund something that maybe in the past wasn't as glamorous. You know, fermented foods to me are wonderful to study, as I mentioned before, but again, that's a little bit outside of what they've normally funded.
We really appreciate your time, Bob. This has been terrific.
Yeah, thanks, Bob. That was wonderful. And we really appreciate you giving your time to this. And we know you're such an enthusiast for this field. And I hope that came across. I'm sure it did. Thank you again. And we'll sign off here.